Hello, it's John Dennis on Friday the 30th of January. Today the government explains how printing money may help Britain out of recession.
Once there are no interest rate cuts left in the central bank's locker, it can start to buy assets, typically government bonds.
Also today, Hamas celebrates victory over Israel. Now for the battle with Fatah.
Hamas certainly believes that it has scored a victory simply by surviving 22 days of conflict.
And with regional elections tomorrow in Iraq, the country moves closer to becoming a functioning democracy.
There are roughly 440 parties and individuals on the ballot, but only about 20 of them have Islam or Islamist or Islamic in their title.
Guardian Daily with John Dennis on guardian.co.uk.
But first, let's hear what's in the news headlines and have a look at today's papers with Sandy Waugh.
The governor of Illinois in the USA has been removed from office. The state Senate unanimously convicted Rod Blagojevich of abusing his powers after he was accused of trying to sell the national Senate post vacated by Barack Obama when he became president. The governor has the duty to find a replacement senator, but Blagojevich was recorded by the FBI, allegedly negotiating a fee for the job. The state Senate also banned him for life from holding public office. The second most senior state officer, the Lieutenant Governor Patrick Quinn, was sworn in as the new governor. Iceland will be fast-tracked to join the European Union, the Guardian's been told by officials. The tiny country's facing financial collapse and it's expected to apply for EU membership to rescue it. Protests in Iceland against the bankruptcy led to the resignation of the Prime Minister. Officials in the capital believe the country needs to give up its own currency and join the euro. We'll have the full details later in the programme. Gordon Brown attends the World Economic Forum in Davos today. He's making preparations for the G20 summit of top industrial nations to be held in London in April. He's expected to try to restart world trade talks. Meanwhile, the Turkish Prime Minister has been given a warm welcome home after he walked out of the forum. Recep Tayyip Erdogan interrupted the Israeli President Shimon Peres when he was giving a speech defending the invasion of Gaza. "You kill people," said the Turkish leader. There seem to have been several reprisal killings in Gaza after the Israeli withdrawal. Palestinians suspected of helping the Israelis, criminals who escaped from Gaza jail during the invasion, are among those reported being murdered. There have also been attacks on members of the official ruling party, Fatah. We'll have more on the Gaza aftermath later in Guardian Daily. Relations between North and South Korea have fallen apart again. After some years of moving towards greater contact, North Korea said that it's scrapping all military and political agreements with the South. The countries have been technically still at war since the 1950s. Hardly any morning paper carries the same story on its front page. The Financial Times and the Times both feature the same picture of French steelworkers protesting against the government's handling of the economy. The Times says French unions believe the unrest will spread around the world. The Telegraph chooses the story of protests in Britain. The hundreds of strikers who gathered outside one of the largest oil refineries in Lincolnshire yesterday. They're protesting against the use of foreign workers at the Lindsay refinery. The paper also tells us that its latest opinion poll shows Gordon Brown losing his bounce over the economic crisis. The Conservatives continue to increase their lead again. The FT also reports the president of the European Central Bank has warned against banks hoarding cash after all their losses. Jean-Claude Trichet said the financial markets were putting pressure on the banks to hold more capital. The Times chooses another economic story. It tells us the Prime Minister's ordered a house building programme by local councils. He wants them to build thousands more and will try to loosen Treasury rules restricting them. The tabloids go in completely different directions. The Sun claims that hospital managers in Derby have called in an exorcist after reports of a black-clad figure walking the corridors. The Mirror headline reads, "Laughing at justice, Reese's gang sickening cheers as they escape with light jail terms." The paper says three young men who helped the killer of Rhys Jones were sentenced to only 5 years in prison. More on the day's news and breaking stories at guardian.co.uk.
The UK is facing the deepest recession of any developed country, according to the International Monetary Fund. Well, one possible route out of recession is by giving people more cash in the hope that they'll spend it. Interest rates are at an all-time low, but high street banks still won't let go of their money. So maybe central banks should step in. The US economist Milton Friedman said it would be theoretically possible for governments to print more money and then drop banknotes out of a helicopter directly into the hands of a grateful public. Well, the British government's not going to do that, but it has explained how it would proceed if a period of printing more money, or quantitative easing, as economists call it, became necessary. The Observer's economics editor is Heather Stewart. Heather, could you sort of explain to us what quantitative easing is?
Yes, it's a radical set of policies that were used by the Japanese between 2001 and 2006. They sort of pioneered this approach. And once there are no interest rate cuts left in the central bank's locker, it can start to buy assets, typically government bonds, in order to effectively to pump more cash into the banking system in the hope that the banks then lend that on to businesses and families and to drive down interest rates right across the economy.
What are the risks associated with quantitative easing?
Well, it does involve putting taxpayers' money at risk. So the approach that the Federal Reserve in the US has taken, for example, is to buy a very wide range of assets, including corporate bonds, mortgage-backed securities and so on. And the Treasury could lose money on these assets. So, you know, the taxpayer can make a loss. And in the longer term, the risk is that by pumping so much cash into the economy, you eventually create inflation. But as in all these things, and as Mervyn King explained recently, you are balancing the risks of taking a policy in the short term against the risks of a very great depression. It's a much worse risk of a severe and prolonged contraction in the economy. And so there is a risk of inflation, but the policymakers might judge that that's less of a risk than the sort of catastrophic decline in output that we're now facing.
Does the Treasury think we're at a point yet where quantitative easing is necessary?
It doesn't yet, but what the letters that were released showed us was that they think we are getting close to that point. Interest rates are now at 1.5%, which is their lowest ever level, which gives the Bank of England very little ammunition. So what the Chancellor was doing yesterday was setting out the rules for when we get to the point where quantitative easing is necessary and sending a strong signal that he's ready for when that point arrives.
Can we expect a further rate cut from the Bank of England? It hasn't got much wriggle room, as you say. 1.5% is an all-time low, but will it lower the base rate even further?
Yes, I think it will. In the United States, the Federal Reserve has cut interest rates all the way down to a level of 0.25%. And next week, the Bank of England will meet on Wednesday and Thursday. Its Monetary Policy Committee will meet to set interest rates, and the city certainly expects at least another half point cut at that point.
And is that the point where the government will begin to buy up bonds and set in train the process of quantitative easing?
Perhaps not yet. I think the bank would be likely to wait and see what the effects of that next interest rate cut are, and it could even wait until interest rates are down at, say, 0.5% before it undertakes quantitative easing. And what the Chancellor and the Governor agreed in their exchange of public letters, which were published yesterday, was that when the Governor gets to that point, he will have to go back to number 11 Downing Street and ask Alistair Darling's permission specifically to undertake quantitative easing.
Meanwhile, Heather, many Western business leaders as well as politicians are attending the World Economic Forum in Davos. Has it turned into a wake for capitalism?
Not quite, I don't think. I'm told by colleagues that are there that the atmosphere is a lot more sombre and less celebratory than usual. And instead of discussing the broad range of issues that are often talked about, international development, debt relief, and so on, it's very much focused on this credit crunch and this downturn and what can be done about it. And I think there are a number of people feeling at least a little bit guilty and humbled that they didn't spot it coming, and perhaps they feel slightly responsible for it happening. So I think it's a somewhat more sombre event than in previous years.
Heather Stewart. Iceland, whose prime minister was the first world leader to resign over his country's financial collapse, may soon be put on a fast track to joining the European Union. It's also expected to adopt the euro as its currency. In Brussels, with the details, our Europe editor, Ian Traynor.
It's been severely hit, particularly by the financial meltdown in the banking sector over recent months. There's unprecedented scenes of riots in the streets of Reykjavik, you know, riot police being deployed, and the first government to fall, certainly in Europe, directly as a result of economic meltdown and financial crash. So this week, Geir Harde, the Prime Minister Conservative, who's, you know, his party has been running Iceland for 18 years, had to stand down. Prime Minister standing down has also been diagnosed with cancer. And in the meantime, we're getting a caretaker government of Social Democrats and Greens, a centre-left government, until new elections can be staged. And the Social Affairs Minister, the leader of the Social Democrats, is the new Prime Minister, is an openly gay woman. So that's another first for Iceland. Unprecedented times up in the Arctic.
And how might Iceland pull itself back from the brink?
Well, one rescue plan that's being mooted at the moment is fast-track straight into the European Union. Basically, there will not be an election, a general election in Iceland, probably in May, but sometime between April and June. And to restore confidence in the whole system, and psychological support for a society that has hit the rails. One solution being mooted is to join the European Union, and most particularly to join the single currency, the euro. Basically, the Icelandic currency, the krona, has been wrecked by the financial crash. It's currently worth less than half the value it was several months ago. Pensions have been destroyed, been wiped out, savings, and so on and so forth. And it's a tiny country, a small country, and in fact, it's the smallest country and smallest economy in the world with its own independent currency. That currency is effectively now dead, according to very senior Icelandic officials. And the only way out of this mess is to get themselves a new currency. And the only option, therefore, if you're looking for a new currency, is the euro, particularly since the Icelandic economy is so integrated into the European economy in any case. It only makes sense to go that way. So all of a sudden, both in Brussels and in Reykjavik, political leaders and policymakers are talking about joining the European Union. The word is that a formal application to join the EU could be made before the summer. Whether it comes before the election or after the election remains to be seen. If that application is made, it would be fast-tracked because it would be quite easy to integrate Iceland into the European Union, and it already basically conforms to a lot of the legislation, a lot of the bureaucratic procedures that are involved in joining.
Ian Traynor. And there's more economic news at guardian.co.uk/business. Also on The Guardian's website today, what Barack Obama means for the future of medicine. Sarah Bosley looks at stem cell research at guardian.co.uk/health. Larry Elliott looks at what Macbeth can teach us about the recession at guardian.co.uk/business. And it's your last chance to apply for a free personal trainer to coach you for the London Marathon. guardian.co.uk/fitness. In Gaza, more than 1,200 people were killed in 3 weeks of attacks by Israel earlier this month. But just days after Israeli troops left the Palestinian territory, Hamas staged victory celebrations, as Rory McCarthy reports from Gaza.
A few days after the war ended, Hamas organised a set of what they said were victory celebrations across the Gaza Strip. Now, I've been to Hamas rallies several times in the past before the war, and then usually heavily attended, quite elaborate shows with music and commandos in evidence. But this time, I have to say, there were very few people joining the demonstrations. And I think that largely reflects the fact that the ordinary population of Gaza was still very shell-shocked from the war. They were still pulling the dead bodies from the rubble. Trying to repair their destroyed homes.
Is there any sense in which Hamas has emerged stronger from the Israeli assault?
It's very difficult to read exactly what's going on inside Hamas. It's always been that way. But my sense from talking to people here in Gaza is that Hamas certainly believes that it has scored a victory simply by surviving 22 days of conflict against Israel's very powerful army. Now, That may be a very misguided understanding, and it's certainly not shared by many people in Gaza who have seen the terrible toll this war has taken on their lives. More than 1,200 people killed, 5,000 injured, more than 20,000 homes either partly or completely destroyed. I think as far as most people are concerned, it was no victory at all. But Hamas seems to be feeling quite bullish, and I think that makes it unlikely that Hamas is going to be signing up to any major compromises in the near future.
Are the unilaterally declared ceasefires of both Hamas and the Israelis holding?
Well, up to a point, there have been rocket attacks from Palestinian militants in the last few days. There was an attack on an Israeli army border patrol in which at least one soldier was killed and three others were injured. From the other side, there have been Israeli attacks which have killed at least three or four people. A couple of those were militants, but others appear to have been civilians, particularly farmers close to the border. So, I mean, there certainly have been violations on both sides. Now, the question is this going to escalate into a return to major conflict? And I think at the moment, probably not. I think there is a lot of pressure on both sides to try and firm up these unilateral ceasefires into something more long-lasting. And there are certainly negotiations going on in Egypt at the moment with the Palestinian factions to try and draw up a longer-term agreement, something that might last for perhaps a year.
One person who has called for long-lasting ceasefires is George Mitchell. He's making his first trip to the Middle East as President Barack Obama's envoy to the region. He's not speaking to anyone from Hamas directly, but do you know, Rory, whether Hamas has any view of the new president in Washington?
It's hard to tell. I mean, they say that they hope that the new president will bring a new approach to Middle East policy. I think many people, you know, share that hope. The question is he going to change, in particular, the policy with regard to Hamas? And George Mitchell has been visiting, but he's been very careful to say that he's just listening at the moment to what all the parties have to say without making any particular pronouncements on new policy directions. He certainly called for the crossings into Gaza to be opened. But when he said that, he also mentioned a return to a particular agreement that was negotiated by the U.S. 3 years ago. And under that agreement, the opening of the crossings would require the presence of the Presidential Guard, which is a force dominated by Fatah, based in the West Bank, and a great rival of Hamas. Fatah has basically no security presence in Gaza at all at the moment. So in order for that to happen, there would have to be a very complicated and important agreement between Hamas and Fatah. And I don't really feel that we're close to that at the moment.
Rory McCarthy in Gaza. I'm John Dennis. Still to come in Guardian Daily, France's general strike. We hear from some of the hundreds of thousands of workers protesting against Sarkozy's policies.
I think the mood in my company and the mood in France is the same, so we are fed up.
But first, voters go to the polls tomorrow in 14 of Iraq's 18 provinces. About 14,400 candidates are competing for 440 seats in the regional elections, and our commentator Jonathan Steele says hopes are high that for the first time since the US-led invasion in 2003, an election will reflect all of Iraq's ethnic communities.
Well, these are the first elections in Iraq for 4 years. They only cover the provincial elections, it's not for the parliament. But nevertheless, it is important because it will be a test of the strength of some of the big Islamist parties that have been running the country for the last 4 years, because they are standing at the provincial level. It's secondly also important because the Sunni Arabs largely boycotted the last election, only about 2% voted. And this time there are various Sunni Arab parties standing, including many of the groups that used to be part of the resistance and then joined up against Al-Qaeda and took training and in some cases cash from the Americans. And now they are now standing for provincial positions in Anbar province and Baghdad and Diyala. So that's quite important to see whether they can really transfer their sort of power to local level into votes.
Will people vote along sectarian lines?
Yes, I think they will be largely voting on whether they're Sunni, Shia or Kurd. That is true, but they may not vote on religious lines, and that's one of the really interesting things about this election, because there are roughly 440 parties and individuals on the ballot, but only about 20 of them have Islam or Islamist or Islamic in their title. And so that suggests that they don't think voters will necessarily respect a party that puts Islam in the title, which is quite important. I mean, the caveat is that these parties are, some of them, Islamist, but they've just changed their name and not kept Islam in the title. But nevertheless, I think it shows that they recognize there is a trend among voters to be rather against the Islamic parties, because they've been in power for the last 4 years. There's a lot of dissatisfaction. The economy is really in free fall. The services, electricity and water, sanitation disposal, you know, garbage disposal and so on, is still very poor. So people are quite dissatisfied with the record of the governing parties, I think.
Have the candidates been able to campaign free of violence and intimidation?
Well, two candidates were shot and killed, but that's out of something like 14,400 candidates, so it's well under 0.1%. But nevertheless, there is a risk, and some people haven't canvassed and gone round and held meetings because of the fear of insecurity. Large parts of Baghdad and some other cities, Diyala, particularly Bakuba, are separated by blast walls still. People can't move from one sectarian area to another because they're afraid. So a lot of it has to be done through the media. And of course, the state TV is still very largely controlled by the ruling party. So it's not a level playing field.
Jonathan Steele. Yesterday, hundreds of thousands of workers across France took to the streets as a general strike paralysed France. Workers are unhappy with President Nicolas Sarkozy's economic policies, his welfare reforms and rising unemployment. The Guardian's Angelique Chrysaphis reports from the streets of Paris.
France is staging the first general strike in any major industrialised country since the crisis. There are hundreds and thousands of people here in Paris on one of the main demonstrations. There are 200 demonstrations all across France. We've seen trains, airports, schools affected, gas, electricity, also private sector, car and steel workers and supermarkets. And the main message is really that Nicolas Sarkozy hasn't done enough to help the French workers. They feel that since the crisis started, a lot of money's gone to banks and business leaders, but not to protect jobs and look after low salaries. Of course, Nicolas Sarkozy is the great reformer. He says he can stand down the street and carry on with his reforms. But there's a general message here today. It's not just about the crisis. It's a lot of people want to put brakes on reforms like justice, hospital and school reforms. Nicolas Sarkozy said last year that no one even notices if there's a strike anymore in France. And the message here today is we're back on the streets, we want to make a difference and we want you to listen to us. Here at the demo, one of the main issues is unemployment. Unemployment is rising very fast in France. We haven't seen such a massive banking crisis here as in the UK, but it's job losses that are causing the problem. We don't have the latest figures because simply the unemployment statisticians are also on strike. But over the next few days, when those figures come out and union leaders meet, then we'll know whether these strikes will continue, whether there'll be any other demonstrations in the coming weeks. What's the general mood in France?
How can I tell you? We are not happy because we see that there are always small people, always the same people who get more and more and more money. And they tell us, you should work more to get more money. But in fact, we work more and more and we don't get anything for that. So that's why we are really unhappy. I think the mood in my company and the mood in France is the same. So we are fed up. In fact, we are fed up with the words of Sarkozy. We are fed up with this guy who is trying to destroy our freedom, to come back on some principles that we had from the revolution, from democracy, voilà. And this kind of thing. And everything is more and more expensive, so it's really difficult to live here now. And all expensive, flats, rents, food, everything.
Angelique Chrysaphis reporting. As if from nowhere, a first-time British filmmaker has appeared with a tremendously accomplished, subtle and supremely confident feature. That's what The Guardian's film critic Peter Bradshaw said in September last year about Unrelated. A few months later, it was named the winner of The Guardian's 2008 First Film Award. Its director, Joanna Hogg, gave her reaction to Jason Solomons on the latest Film Weekly podcast.
I was really surprised and obviously absolutely delighted.
Thoroughly deserved as well. Not the first award you've got. I remember you getting up on stage at the London Film Festival, not this year, last year.
It was actually 2007 and we got the Fipresky Award.
Right, so it's a long journey that one makes with a film like this. So you've been sort of touting it and selling it and going around with it for sort of 2 years now.
Yes, I mean, it's not something I'm doing, obviously, every day. And I feel that today, actually, it feels like a while since I've actually been talking about Unrelated, because I'm now well into getting together my next film.
Oh, brilliant. But, it's always good to hear that when someone does a good first film that they have got something else lined up.
Well, yes.
So often in the British industry, I find that, you know, the directors have great breakthroughs and it takes 4 or 5 years to get another one going.
I know. Well, I really want to try and keep the momentum going. And actually, I'm not very good at this. I'm trying to develop more than one thing at a time because I tend to be someone who just concentrates on one thing and that's the only thing, and I think in this climate right now that's a bit risky to do, so I'm actually juggling, I would say, 3 or 4 things.
Oh, brilliant. Well, we'll talk about those in a minute, but let's go back to Unrelated, if you could cast your mind that far back.
Yes.
So, Joanna, for anyone who hasn't seen it, and I'm afraid there are those who haven't yet, because it's out on DVD February the 2nd, which is very, very exciting as well. So the next opportunity you get is to see this family drama set in a Tuscan villa. You take the story from here, Joanna.
Okay, that's right. It's a story about Anna, who is married in her mid-40s but doesn't have any children. And she's invited to Tuscany to a girlfriend of hers who she's known since school, to her villa that she's rented for the summer. And she arrives without her husband because at the last minute he has work to do. And she gradually, and it's a slow burn, it's not a film that has, you know, a fast pace to it, yet it's sort of very, has a momentum to it. And Anna, who is having difficulties in her marriage and also coming to terms with not having children. And she is also someone who's never really had a wild teenage time in her life. So she kind of starts to relive that, or rather live it for the first time, through the teenage children of her friend.
But I just wondered if this, you know, it seems such a familiar scenario, but it's the sort of thing we don't see that often in British film.
That's right. I mean, I don't know why that is exactly, but it's something that I wouldn't say I've exactly had those kind of holidays myself, but I've observed them and I have sometimes participated in quite a peripheral way to situations like that. So I find it very fascinating. And actually, that relationship that you describe between Anna and Verena, in a way, we don't need to say that much about it because you understand quite quickly what that friendship that's been ongoing for many years, but it's clear they've sort of lost contact as well.
And does it work, this kind of, you know, critical acclaim? Because people now will say, oh, well, she did Unrelated, let's give her some more money for a next one.
Well, I'm waiting for that to happen, actually. And right now, for one of my projects, we're trying to get the money together. So,
but do you think, well, I'll try a bigger budget next time? Because that people might get, or are you very much going to stay in that kind of limits?
I'm going to try and stay within those limits. I think it's much more rewarding and actually rather appropriate for this climate right now.
Joanna Hogg talking to Jason Solomons. Phil Maynard and Tim Mabey produced today's edition of Guardian Daily. I'm John Dennis. Thanks for listening.